here with us today. He'll be
how's that? There we go. Sorry about the sound problems there. Yeah, good day to all of you that are here in person, and good day to all of you who are joining us virtually through YouTube live. And, you know, my book, Design to the Core, is all about the fine-tuning argument being far more comprehensive than it's been acknowledged in other books. The book is now available. You can get Design to the Core all the way up through August through a donation of any amount to Reasons to Believe. It'll have a general release at the beginning of September. And you can also find quite a bit of material on the fine-tuning argument for God in the book The Creator and the Cosmos, now in its fourth edition. And anyone can get a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross. Now this morning, I made a post quite early about a Roman Catholic priest, a bishop in Colorado, who wrote a really fine piece. And I gave a link on both my Twitter and Facebook pages this morning to the article he wrote about how the James Webb Space Telescope is declaring the glory of God. And you know, something I've made mention of earlier is that when the Bible repeatedly says the heavens declare the glory of God, it's in the context of people lived in the days of Abraham, Jacob, and King David. I mean, you could actually go outside at night and see the heavens. And we're at a disadvantage in the 21st century because the vast majority of the human population, when they go outside at night, they're lucky if they can see 30 stars. And maybe see a couple of the planets and the moon, and that's about it. Abraham, when he would look out at the night sky, could see 15,000 stars. He could see the Milky Way and all of its detail, and he saw it as quite a bright represent. And they were seeing the heavens declaring the glory of God every night. And you know, here in the Los Angeles area, you struggle to see 30 stars, even on a clear night. But if you go to the big Asian cities, you don't see any stars at all, even on a clear night. In fact, one of our employees at Reasons to Believe was hosting a student from China. And she said, "You've got to tell me, what's that object in the sky?" And they said, "Well, that's the moon." And she had not recognized the moon. Now she says, "Oh yeah, in China, we can see the moon, but only when it's directly overhead. When it's low in the horizon, the light and air pollution is so intense that you can't see the moon." So the heavens really are not declaring the glory of God to any degree compared to what the ancients were able to see because of the modern technology of light pollution. Matter of fact, there really is no place on the surface of planet Earth today where there is zero light pollution. There's some everywhere. And so astronomers have been saying, well, if you go to the backside of the moon, maybe you can actually see the heavens like the ancients got to see them. However, what I appreciated about what this bishop wrote this morning and had it published in the Pueblo newspaper is he said, when you look at the James Webb Space Telescope, the heavens are declaring the glory of God in a way that's unique to those of us living in the 21st century. And so, again, I made a link to the article. Take a look at it. But I just wanted to show you a couple of things I did put earlier, about a week ago, on my Facebook and Twitter pages, which is a comparison of the few images released. There's been seven images released from the Hubble Space Telescope. Five of them were released about 10 days ago. And I posted three of them on my Facebook and Twitter pages. And I chose the three that actually reveal new science. Because a couple of the images, at least in my opinion, were publicity things. Look how much better this telescope is than the Hubble Space Telescope. But I will show you a comparison. So this is the Hubble Space Telescope image of a cluster of galaxies known as SMAX 0737. That's Hubble Space Telescope, and this is the James Webb Space Telescope. So you can notice the difference. Hubble and the James Webb. And what you notice in the James Webb Space Telescope image, you're not just seeing the cluster of galaxies, you're seeing background galaxies. And if you look carefully at this image and come up close, you can see that there's a couple of stars. You can see the things with six cross images. Those are stars. Everything else is galaxies. And you can see these little tiny galaxies here. Literally, you're looking billions of light years away. The cluster of galaxies that you see here is 4.6 billion light years away. But the background images are predominantly of galaxies that are 10 to 13 billion light years away. And this is a cluster of galaxies that acts as a gravitational lens. So what you can see in the Hubble Space Telescope image is that you can see that some of these images seem streaked. And that's the result of the cluster of galaxies acting as a gravitational lens so that the galaxies that are in the background, the cluster of galaxies is basically magnifying the very distant galaxies as the light bends around it. And you can see this in much more detail in the James Webb Space Telescope image. You can see not just one or two elongated streaks of lens background galaxies, but literally dozens of them. So here, 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 down here, here. So you can actually see the cluster of galaxies in a rather complex way, multiple lens way, lensing galaxies that are many billions of light years more distant than what you see there. Another image that was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, where they've done a comparison, is what's known as Stefan's Quintet. And because the universe is only 13.8 billion years old, there are places in the universe where you do see galaxies still quite close together. Now, only four of these five galaxies are actually gravitationally linked together. The fifth one is a foreground galaxy. So this one is a galaxy that's actually not associated with these others. It's a foreground galaxy, but the other galaxy. Now, this is the best image that the Hubble Space Telescope has taken. You'll find five online, but this is the deepest and the best of the Hubble Space Telescope images. But compare that with the James Webb Space Telescope. And what you notice is you're getting approximately equal detail of the five galaxies. The difference is the background. When you look in the background, you can see hundreds of distant galaxies, more distant galaxies in the background, and you can actually see a lot of detail about them. So that's the Hubble Space Telescope. And the background there is predominantly dominated by foreground stars, whereas in the case of the James Webb Space Telescope, you're seeing all these background galaxies. And this is actually providing us with more evidence for the biblically predicted Big Bang creation model. If you go on reasons.org and look up some of my articles titled Today's New Reason to Believe, you'll find two that document how the Bible predicted at least three and possibly four of the fundamental features of what we call the Big Bang creation model. And one of the predictions of the Big Bang creation model is that in the early universe, many galaxies will be spiral galaxies. But as the universe expands and these galaxies get older and older, these spiral galaxies will either merge together to become spheroidal galaxies, where the spiral arm structure collapses, or the spiral galaxies will stop consuming small dwarf galaxies as the universe spreads apart. The supply of small dwarf galaxies for the spiral galaxies goes down. And so one of the predictions is we should see a decline in the density of spiral galaxies as we move forward in the universe. And what you notice with the James Webb Space Telescope of both Stefan's Quintet and also with this cluster of galaxies is that we see these very distant galaxies, and you notice how many of them are spiral in their structure. And so this is verifying that indeed there is a greater proportion of galaxies that were spirals in the early universe compared to the present universe. And one of the big debates that takes place between young Earth creationists and old Earth creationists is that young Earth creationists insist that star formation stopped at the end of creation day four, whereas astronomers are convinced that star formation is an ongoing process. And this next set of images, this is a portion of the Carina Nebula, and that's with the Hubble Space Telescope, and that's the best image that Hubble was able to pull off. And this is a preliminary image from the James Webb Space Telescope. And again, the big difference is that these best images from the Hubble Space Telescope, we're talking multiple hours of observing time in order to get the image that they got, whereas these images that have just been released were taken in much less time. So it's basically demonstrating the power of this telescope. And what you're seeing as you compare this portion of the Carina Nebula, Hubble Space Telescope, James Webb Space Telescope, in fact, astronomers have commented, this is where we see the most spectacular difference between what you get with the Hubble telescope compared to the James Webb Space Telescope. As you look at this image, you can see it's just covered with regions of star formation in the sense that you get these columns of cold gas where you got hot gas squeezing them in, and it basically causes that gas cloud, a cloud of gas and dust, to collapse, and then gravity takes over and it forms a new star. And there's literally dozens of stars that are forming in this region. And notice you can see all the details of the gas clouds. And astronomers are going to be able to measure the velocities of these clouds and determine which parts of the clouds are expanding, which parts are collapsing, and where we can expect to see new stars at different stages of star formation. This kind of image has never been taken before. With the Hubble Space Telescope, they were able to look at other gas clouds where they could see some of these collapsing elephant trunks. But this is just the first image taken by the James Webb Space Telescope of quite a distant molecular gas cloud. And you can just see an incredible amount of detail that previously was not possible at all. So yes, in the 21st century, typically we look at the night sky and we don't see much at all with our naked eye, but God has compensated for that by allowing us to develop this amazing technology where we can see the heavens declaring the glory of God like never before. And what I appreciate about this Catholic bishop is he talked about star formation and galaxy formation and how the James Webb Space Telescope is going to reveal details of design and how stars form, how galaxies form, in such a manner that we get the right kind of gas cloud that collapses into a planetary system in which advanced life can exist, which can look at the universe and see the glory of God manifested. So that's why I posted it this morning, because I said, you know, he's right on target. Just like the Hubble Space Telescope gave us insights into the way the universe has been designed to reflect the glory of God and His creation. We're going to see that to a far greater degree with the James Webb Space Telescope. And what he did not comment on, there are several other telescope building projects underway that are going to add to the evidence for design. So what I've done in this book, Design to the Core, is basically give you an update on the very latest evidences for the fine-tuned designs of the universe, basically revealing chapter by chapter. No matter what size scale we look at, from the very largest size scales down to the smallest cosmic size scales, we see overwhelming evidence for design. What I'm sharing with you is that thanks to the James Webb Space Telescope and another telescope nobody's paying attention to, which is called the Square Kilometer Array. It's a radio telescope that's actually operating right now, but when it's completely finished, it's going to have a collecting area of 1 square kilometer. It's a radio telescope, and I'm convinced that that telescope is going to reveal designs that are not going to be that are going to be new design that no other telescope can see. So James Webb is getting all the publicity, and yeah, the photographs, the images are amazing, but there's other telescopes going on. One called the Extremely Large Telescope, which is actually an optical telescope with a mirror that measures 100 feet across. And there's even one that's going to be larger than that. So a lot to look forward to as we continue on into the 21st century. But what I want to talk about, last time I was here 2 weeks ago, I talked about the attempts that atheists have made to discount the fine-tuning argument and why their attempts fail. But I want to take a more positive approach in today's talk. And, you know, I mentioned this last time I was with you, is how as time goes by, we see more and more evidence for the design of the universe to make possible the existence of microbes, not even advanced life, just microbes. And you can see the documentation, the citations to the peer-reviewed literature at reasons.org/fine-tuning. But it basically documents the principle we see in Job and Psalms, that the more we study, the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we'll discover, the more evidence we'll uncover for the supernatural handiwork of God, and the more it's going to reveal to us the attributes of God. And we see this in the universe as a whole. What I'm trying to demonstrate in Design to the Core, we see this at all cosmic size levels. So last time I was with you, I went through these four predominant critiques of the fine-tuning argument that atheists have marshaled. That message is recorded, and there's part of a chapter in Design to the Core where I talk about these four attempts to dismiss the fine-tuning argument for God as we observe the universe. So that's, you can download that at paradoxes.org. And yes, this is well acknowledged in the astronomical community that we need a just right universe for life to exist. And as I mentioned previously, I've got 50 books in my office upstairs in this building, written predominantly by people who are not believers, acknowledging that we look at the universe as a whole, we see overwhelming evidence. It's been designed to make humans exist, but also for any kind of life to exist. But typically, they do not dig down any deeper than that. They just simply look at the universe as a whole. And I think for people who are not followers of Jesus Christ, that's a comfortable position because now they can just keep God at an arm's length. The problem with acknowledging the design of our galaxy or our star or our planetary system or of our moon or our planet Earth, now we have this God involved much closer to us. But I want to spend the remaining time of my talk today looking at the design of what astronomers call the large-scale structure of the universe. And this is a recently published map, and it's a map of the large-scale structure, literally of the entire observable universe. And that little red dot you see in the image, that dot overlaps the Lanikaia supercluster, which contains the Virgo cluster of galaxies, which contains the local group of galaxies, which contains our Milky Way galaxy. To give you an idea of the size scale here, that little red dot is a whole lot bigger than the Lanikaia supercluster. In fact, it actually covers what are called the local superclusters of galaxies. Say, what's a supercluster of galaxies? It's a cluster of clusters of galaxies. And actually, most of the little white dots you see here are what astronomers call superclusters of galaxies. In other words, a single dot there would represent not just a supercluster of galaxies, but a cluster of superclusters of galaxies. But what you notice in this image, and what's interesting about this image, is that the sensitivity drops off as you go from that red dot, which overlaps the Lanikaia supercluster and local superclusters. As you go out, the sensitivity drops, just because we don't have very powerful telescopes. But even with that, you notice we live in what's called a void. This is a region where we don't see. In fact, we don't see any nearby superclusters of galaxies. We do see superclusters of galaxies, but none of them are very close to us. And because we're in this void within the observable universe, where we don't have any superclusters of galaxies, and where the superclusters of galaxies are relatively far apart from one another, it means that we're in a region of the observable universe where we're not going to have some really big, supermassive black holes. And actually, there we got another language problem, too. Astronomers define a supermassive black hole as a black hole that comes in at more than a million times the mass of our star, the Sun. Every large galaxy has got a supermassive black hole. But a term I use in design to the core are supermassive black holes. And these are black holes that come in at greater than 1 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. The biggest one that astronomers have seen is 17 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. The biggest one that's close enough to be of concern to us is a supermassive black hole in the center of M87, which is near the core of the Virgo cluster of galaxies. It comes in at 6.5 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. And fortunately, its jet of deadly radiation is pointed away from us. And hey, it's 53 million light years away. So it's far away, and its deadly jet is pointed away from us. But that's not what you'd expect as you move beyond this local region. As you get out into this part here, we see it's filled with these galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and notice how close they are to one another, how bright some of them are, and that's a region where you're going to be exposed to these deadly supermassive black holes. So we are in an underdense region of the universe, and this actually explains why you have what's called the expansion rate tension, where our measurements of the expansion of the universe are a little faster than the measurements we get in the distant universe. Because we live in an underdense region, that actually is going to add a little factor to the measured cosmic expansion rate, because you're actually going to have peculiar velocities that are going to add to the cosmic expansion rate. Now, that is looking at what's called the largest scale structure of the universe. As we look at the next layer of structure, this is where we begin to look at structures in the universe that are less than 840 million light years across. And when you do that, you actually see what's called the cosmic web. And so this is a map of a region of the universe a little closer to home to kind of compare that with this one. You're basically looking at about this much of the universe, and this is what you see. You see this cosmic web-like structure. Now, I was going to show you a video clip, but it would take me too much time to set it up. So, you can go on YouTube and you'll see about four really good video where they actually take you through a fly-through through the cosmic web, where you get to go through this cosmic web and you look along these little structures and you get to see the galaxies and the galaxy clusters that are there. Well, I'll show you instead, since I don't have time, but again, go to YouTube and enjoy a tour through these cosmic web computer simulations that you'll see there. But this kind of gives you a look at what's going on with the cosmic web. And what's happening is that the anisotropies in the quantum space-time fluctuations of the early universe. And we're basically talking about the universe before it's a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. When it's that young, the quantum space-time fluctuations play a significant role in the dynamics of the universe, and those anisotropies will grow as the universe expands. And you basically get the production of these bubbles. And what's generating these bubbles is that you've got a combination of dark matter and ordinary matter. Dark matter is matter that does not interact well with light. It either interacts not at all or very weakly with light, compared with matter that we're all familiar with, ordinary matter, matter that's made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. That has the property of strongly interacting with light. And what happens is that you've got these quantum space-time fluctuations expanding and creating these these little anisotropies. But what makes it bubble-like is the fact that you get the ordinary matter and the dark matter collapsing down to a little core. But because the ordinary matter strongly interacts with light, you get radiation that kind of goes out. If you want an analogy, think of our star, the sun. And this, in the case of the sun, made up of all this ordinary matter, that matter under gravity causes the sun to collapse. But counteracting the collapse of our star, the sun, is the radiation from the nuclear fusion. So the radiation from the nuclear furnace in the core of the star is forcing the sun to get bigger and bigger. Now, the reason why we don't see any change in the size of the sun is that the radiation pressure that's forcing the sun to expand is counterbalanced by the gravity, which is forcing it to contract. And the two forces are equal. And so the sun is basically stable in its diameter. A similar phenomenon is happening here with these bubbles. You've got the collapse of ordinary and dark matter towards these cores. But the ordinary matter, because it strongly interacts with radiation, you get this expansion. And so what happens is the ordinary matter gets distributed in a bubble around this core. The dark matter stays here. Now, the reason why you see something here, because there's about 5 to 6 times more dark matter than there is ordinary matter in the universe, the dark matter, its gravity is strong enough that it's going to actually retain a small amount of ordinary matter with it. So in these cosmic bubbles, you see some ordinary matter in the core, and that's because of the very powerful gravity of the dark matter. That so you do get some ordinary matter here, but most of the ordinary matter gets blown out by the radiation. And so it's distributed along this bubble. And so on the surface of the bubble is where you find the ordinary matter of the universe. So on the surface of these bubbles, and again, I can go back to this image here. On the surface of the bubbles is where you're going to have the super galaxy clusters, the clusters of galaxies, the local groupings. And as you can see here, the bubbles are complex. On the surface of the bubbles, you have all these filaments. And along these filaments, you'll have clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies and groupings of galaxies. And also, you're going to have galaxies and clusters of galaxies in the centers of each of the bubbles because of the fact that that's where the dark matter exists. So the dark matter dominates that. But here's the bottom line. And this was pointed out more than a decade ago by an old-time friend of mine, Robert Kirshner. He was at Caltech the same time I was a couple of years ahead of him. But he's recognized today as the world's foremost expert on supernova. And he was the one that was actually for the first time able to explain why it is that this bubble-like cosmic web structure exists in the universe. But he also pointed out that because of this bubble-like structure, you call it kind of like soap bubbles, aggregates of soap bubbles, is because of that, we now have the ordinary matter distributed at just the right way to make life possible. In other words, if it wasn't for this ratio of 5 to 6 times more dark matter than ordinary matter, these bubbles wouldn't form, and if they didn't form, the ordinary matter would be far too condensed to make life possible. He says the universe is only 13.8 billion years old, and you need to actually get things going faster to make life possible, and he referred to this as the end of greatness. Now, what he's referring to is if you go from Earth and look farther and farther away, as you go up farther and farther, you see all this amazing cosmic design to make life possible, but you reach a point where you no longer see this amazing level of design. He called it the end of greatness. I prefer to call it the beginning of greatness. You begin with the moment of the universe. The universe has the just right mass, the just right dark energy, the just right dark matter, so that as the universe expands, you actually get stars and galaxies. As I mentioned in Design to the Core, it takes amazing design of the very early moments of the universe to get the elements we need for life and to get galaxies and stars. And so you would expect with a cosmic creation event that's not governed by God in terms of his intervention, that you'd wind up with the universe with no stars and no galaxies at all. But it was Robert Kirshner who pointed out, you not only need a universe with stars and galaxies for light to be possible, it's essential that those stars and galaxies be distributed in a highly fine-tuned way. And he says the amazing thing about this cosmic web, it ensures that the ordinary matter is distributed on the surface of these bubbles along these filaments in such a way that you can get structures like our Virgo cluster of galaxies, like our local group of galaxies. If it wasn't for these bubbles, there'd be no possibility for local galaxy groupings with the features that would make life possible. And so what I want to talk about the next time I'm here, I'm going to be speaking at the American Scientific Affiliation meeting next Sunday, actually giving my talk on Sunday, but I'll be back here in 2 weeks to speak about the next level of design, how we go from a just right universe to a just right cosmic web to a just right super galaxy cluster, and actually look at our super galaxy cluster compared with all the other known superclusters of galaxies. And what's unique about our superclusters of galaxies, that makes life possible, not just human life, but even any kind of life to be possible. And as vast as the universe as it is, with tens of thousands of super clusters of galaxies and super galaxy clusters, we live in the one super galaxy cluster that has the characteristics to make life possible, and in particular, advanced life possible. But life is not going to be possible in a super cluster of galaxies. It is possible in a super cluster of galaxies, but it needs to be highly fine-tuned. But the web itself needs to be fine-tuned. And you'll see a whole chapter on that in the design of the core. Well, I'm past my 30 minutes, so I'm going to stop here. I'll take questions. And as usual, we'll take questions from the live audience, in-person audience, and we'll also take questions from the live virtual audience. So we'll alternate back and forth. And Mark, I'll have you moderate.
All right. Am I coming through on this?
Can we all hear Mark? We got another microphone here because, yeah, we want to get this recorded. Here we go.
Okay, is that coming through all right?
No, it's not coming through either.
Well,
I'll tell you what, if you give me the question, I'll repeat it.
Okay.
Oh, now you're on.
Okay. I have one on a new technology I was reading about called gravitational wave radar, or GRADAR. And some are predicting it'll be able to detect dark matter. Do you know anything about that yet?
I probably shouldn't comment on it, because if you're talking gravity wave radar, that means you're sending out gravity waves, having a bounce back, and actually getting some information. Sounds like a great idea. I think technologically we're a long ways from being able to make that happen. It's one thing to detect gravity waves from merging black holes, but to actually have something to send out a gravity wave with enough power that you can see it reflected and coming back to you. Now, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question.
No, you're right.
If I'm right on, then I wouldn't be sitting on your edge of your seat waiting for that to happen. I don't know of anyone. I mean, yeah, if you could kind of marshal the power that you see in the merging of neutron stars, then that kind of technology would be possible. But for humans to be able to manage that, I mean, the CERN particle accelerator does not have sufficient energy to make that happen. Not by a long shot. Okay, we got a question here.
I'll go ahead and do another one in-house, and then I'll take a couple.
Okay.
Good. Three questions. The first one is, my boss is the atheist, and he showed me about 2 weeks ago where they probably saw these galaxies. I don't remember seeing them on the news. But he says, do you see that? And what he's trying to tell me, how did God did?
Do you think God did that? Well, I couldn't explain it until I just hear it now. And my question is, before the universe, there was nothing, right? Nothing. And then God produced everything. And that's part of the galaxies, all of them. Is that right?
That's right. And to get galaxies at all takes supernatural fine-tuning.
Okay. So the second question is kind of a question that implies design. What are the cockroaches good for?
What are cockroaches good for? Well, as you probably are aware, cockroaches will eat anything. And so they'll take care of stuff that no one else takes care of. I mean, that's true of insects in general. They're ones that feed on material that if that wasn't the case, it could cause a problem. So they clean up after us. And so you notice that, cockroaches tend to hang around messy people because they know they leave a lot of debris and a lot to feed on. So Just like there's mites on your body that feed on all your dead skin. They process that dead skin. Somebody's got to take care of it. And just like mosquitoes, people say, well, why are there mosquitoes? Well, mosquitoes, at least where I was raised in Canada, they're the one species of life that feed on lemming poop. And so they process the lemming poop. So, and I'm not a cockroach expert, but you can actually go online and you'll see quite a bit on cockroaches. I've been there. And, you know, cockroaches have different sizes in different places. I've been to the tropics where the cockroaches are, you know, can like 2 inches long. They're much bigger than the ones we have here. So
I was telling my boss, even the cockroach has programs that designed to run away from you to survive.
Well, one of the amazing features of cockroaches, you're probably aware that they seem to be able to get in almost anywhere. Well, their bodies are designed so that their skeletal structure can collapse down to a thin wafer and they can get under your door or get under a little sliver of your window. So yeah, the cockroach might be a quarter of an inch high, but because it can collapse its body down to a fraction of a millimeter, it can get into places that larger insects are not able to get into. So they're hard to get rid of. And also, they're able to survive under very harsh environments. I mean, if there's an all-out nuclear war, every human being on planet Earth will be wiped out, but the cockroaches will survive.
So I was telling my boss, that's design.
That is design.
Yes. And the next question is, what's that light, line from the circumference?
No. This is taken from a peer-reviewed scientific paper where they're basically trying to describe what's going on in these cosmic bubbles. And so a little line you see there is talking about the average diameter of the bubble.
Okay.
So it's giving you an idea. And that line encompasses several hundred million light years. And again, the extent of the Lanikaia supercluster is only a few hundred million light years. So it gives you an idea of the size of the bubbles.
Thank you. We got a question from Doug McComb. And he asked, how long will the James Webb telescope last? And could it have been designed to be more protected from meteorites?
Well, the James Webb Space Telescope will continue operating until it runs out of fuel. And astronomers think, it depends on the research programs that they do, but they anticipate that the fuel lasts about 30 years. And when it runs out of fuel, and why it needs fuel, it needs a fuel supply in order to point the telescope in the various directions it wants. So when it runs out of fuel, they'll no longer be, it'll just be looking at one spot in the sky. And so that's one reason why they made the telescope as light as it is. It only weighs half as much as the Hubble Space Telescope, in spite of the fact that the mirror is almost 6 times greater in diameter, has about 25 times more collecting area. But on purpose, they made it really light so that the fuel supply would be sufficient to keep it operating for 30 years. But one concern is they've already discovered a micrometeorite puncture in the James Webb Space Telescope. And they were anticipating this would happen, but the fact that it's happened this soon is some concern. And so astronomers are worried that micrometeorites, or even bigger meteorites, could make the telescope non-functional in less than 30 years. And if you look at that sun shield, you'll see that they got 5 different layers. And the reason why they designed it with 5 layers of sun shielding is that they recognize, okay, we get a micrometeorite puncturing one, maybe the one underneath. You can get one that goes through all 5, but it'll go through all 5 at an angle. That means that the sun shield will still function appropriately. But yeah, they only had 1 layer, then a puncture would now mean that sun shield wouldn't be as effective. You say, what happens if the sun shield gets significantly degraded? That means the temperature of the infrared detectors at the focal point of the James Webb telescope will not be as sensitive as it otherwise would be. I mean, because of those sun shields, that detector is only a few degrees above absolute zero, which explains why you're getting these amazingly sensitive images in just a short period of time. It's because of that very cold temperature of the infrared detector. But if the sun shield gets damaged significantly, the temperature will go up and make the telescope less sensitive. So those are the dangers. But the thinking is, and the hope is, that it'll be giving us these high-quality images for the next 30 years.
Yeah, there was a comment back from Slam RN. I think that's Susan.
That's Susan Lambeau, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, she said they're looking at least 10 years, but it may last 20. They spent less fuel than expected getting it settled into place in the Lagrange point.
Well, that's one reason why they said they think they can make it last 30 years.
Yeah.
Because they were much more efficient on getting the telescope to the Lagrange point. But that's a guess. A lot of it depends on what the astronomers want to look at and how they do their observing. So the guess is 30 years. But there's reason for some optimism, because the Hubble Space Telescope has lasted a whole lot longer than what they anticipated when they put it up there. So, but, you know, as I've read the literature on this, 30 years is maximal. Beyond that, there's not much.
Okay.
And so we're going to need another, it's going to need to be replaced.
Are they already designing another?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one thing is they're realizing the taxpayer is up for it, because they're seeing these amazing images and realizing, wow, we're discovering more. One person has made this comment on my Facebook page saying, you know, what's going to happen with the James Webb Telescope? It's going to make the argument for the God of the Bible far more persuasive than it's been in the past. And maybe the non-theists won't be excited about putting up another telescope that's going to reveal even more design. But astronomers are really interested in getting more instruments up. However, there is some pushback from some astronomers saying, if we had spent that $10 billion building better ground-based telescopes, we may have been able to discover more. And that's all because the original price was a little more than $1 billion. But just like it is when you try to remodel your home, the estimate you get tends to be a little on the low side.
You got a comment from Sentinel Apologetics. He says, my health is back 100%, and I'm looking forward to interviewing you, I guess, on the 28th on the topic.
Well, that's good news, because
yeah.
We actually prayed for Robert.
Yeah,
that's
did.
Robert Rowe in Perth, Australia, and he had some health issues. I'm glad to hear that he's 100% back again. And, yeah, I am aware I'm going to be interviewed by him on a show sometime in the next few days, I think.
Great.
So thank you, Robert. Good to hear that.
Any in-house questions?
Yes.
Hi, Dr. Ross, buddy. So about this cosmic bubble, I'm slightly confused about the photonic interaction. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that this happened very, very early in the universe, like
yes.
The first instant. My understanding from other readings of yours is that photons, the universe was so hot and dense early that photons couldn't even freeze out. You know, they weren't even, you couldn't even manage, that photons couldn't even exist because of the heat.
No, they existed. The problem in the very early universe is that the density and the energy levels of the photons were such that all the ordinary matter was completely ionized. It took the expansion, the cooling down of the universe for atoms to form and later for molecules to form. So in the early universe, the universe is too hot for atoms to form. You have electrons, protons, you've got nuclei of atoms, so you've got oxygen nuclei, but they're completely stripped of their electrons, and therefore you don't have atoms.
Got it. So if we've got electrons and we have photons, the cosmic microwave background radiation didn't happen until 380,000 years after the Big Bang. Is that correct?
Well, the maps of the cosmic background radiation show you that moment in the early history of the universe when atoms first form. So when atoms form, you actually can see the distinctions between the dense parts of the universe and the less dense. When the universe is so hot that all the matter is ionized, you get the same glow everywhere. So you don't see any distinction between the dense regions and the void regions of the universe.
I got it.
It takes atoms to form for us to be able to see that.
Also, just a side question, is this related to the baryonic oscillation measurement that the Planck did so accurately?
I was trying to avoid that term because I didn't want to get into the technicals. But yeah, what you're seeing here is what we refer to as a baryon acoustic oscillations. And you know, I do my best to explain that for lay readers in the design to the core, but that's what you're seeing here, baryon acoustic oscillations. And basically what's happening is that the photons associated with the ordinary matter are generating this radiation pressure, which pushes out the ordinary matter onto the surfaces of these bubbles. Now, this is an idealized diagram you see here. What it really looks like for real is like this. They are bubbles, but they're complex. Not all the bubbles are the same size. And when you see in the surfaces of the bubbles, it's not an even distribution of galaxies. It's a complex network of filaments. And along the filaments, you have these different galaxy clusters. So this is an idealized diagram, which is basically showing you these bubbles with this central bit of matter that's there because of the gravity from the dark matter. And then along the surface, you see the galaxies, groupings and galaxy clusters. But it's not going to be a perfect circle. It's going to be, and you know, a lot of astronomers refer to it as a bunch of soap bubbles. Because if you have, you know, like a soap bubble bath, you notice that the bubbles are all touching one another, but the bubbles are all different sizes, all different kinds of complexity, and therefore it looks like that.
And is that why the sine wave signature of the measurement from the Planck is this complex waveform? It's not just a uniform sine wave. It's
well,
this complex thing.
That's a different matter. You're talking about the monopole structure of the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that's another level of complexity. Okay. I deal with that in the fourth edition of The Crater in the Cosmos.
Your new book's awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the endorsement.
Okay. We have a question from Germany. Tom Oy.
Mm-hmm.
Good evening from Leipzig, Germany.
Right.
Dr. Ross, I'm interested to know more about the formation of our solar system. Is our sun a third-generation star? And how are the planets formed within?
Well, there's two whole chapters on the planets in Design to the Core, and another chapter that's specific to stars. And yes, our star, the sun, is a third-generation star. The first-generation stars are stars that form out of the primordial hydrogen and helium that's produced in the first few minutes after the Big Bang creation event. But those firstborn stars will take that hydrogen and helium and fuse them into elements like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, and that will be blasted off into interstellar space. And that gas mixture from the exploded remains of dying first-generation stars now becomes the second generation of stars. And because it's got a higher mixture, not just hydrogen and helium, but it's got hydrogen, helium, and carbon, oxygen, iron, and a few other elements. Its nuclear furnace is much more efficient in producing elements that are heavier than helium. And so the third generation stars have a much richer mixture of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. So for the first generation stars, elements heavier than helium measure to be 0%. The first, second generation stars, it's about 1%. The third generation stars, 2 to 3%. Our sun comes in at about 2% elements heavier than helium. That's heavier by mass. So, but what you're going to love about design of the core, it explains how the sun exports a certain set of heavy elements to its rocky planets, and also exports angular momentum from the sun to the rocky planets, and explains why the rocky planets in our solar system are unlike the rocky planets we see in any other planetary system. And so that's really a remarkable design feature, just exactly how the sun was able to export those refractory elements and angular momentum so we can have these dense, heavy metal-rich, big planets orbiting distantly from the host star. And we see nothing like that anywhere else in our Milky Way galaxy.
Dr. Ross, would you be able to suggest one or two scriptures that would identify with specificity design elements and perhaps the earliest design elements that the scriptures could identify? And what would those design elements be?
Okay, well, with respect to what we're talking about here, I've written an article called Big Bang, the Bible Taught It First. So basically making a point that if you go through the Bible, you'll see many texts speaking about the beginning of the universe, including the beginning of space and time itself, where it speaks about the laws of physics being constant, where they haven't changed throughout cosmic history. And it was actually scientists at the Renaissance who looked at these biblical texts and says, and concluded, that means we can look at nature and trust what we see, because there's no change in the laws of physics. And also the Bible speaks about the different laws of physics, probably most extensively, the laws of thermodynamics. And that's where we get the concept that given that the entire universe is subject to a pervasive law of decay that doesn't change, that's a universe that gets colder and colder as it gets older and older as it continues to expand. But in terms of specific design claims in the Bible, I think we're talking a little closer to home. And by the way, I complimented that article on Big Bang, the Bible Taught It First, with another article addressing a pushback I got from that article saying, well, hey, you're a 21st century astronomer, you read the Bible from a Big Bang bias, and therefore you're seeing in the Bible things that they claim are not there, which is why I complimented that with another article where I demonstrated this is not unique to 21st century astronomers. Theologians, both Christian and Jewish theologians, saw this in the Old Testament hundreds of years before astronomers discovered these Big Bang features of the universe. And it takes those Big Bang features to get life in the universe, to get physical life in the universe. We need a universe that's cooling down at just the right rate, expanding at just the right rate, so we get the stars and galaxies and planets and stars in which life is possible. But Steve, I think probably a more dramatic answer to your question, look at what it says in Genesis 1, Genesis 2, Job 37, 38, and 39, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8. Those are the predominant creation texts in the Bible that speak about the scientific details of what God did to prepare Earth and Earth's life so that the epitome of his creation, we human beings, could not only exist on planet Earth, but thrive on planet Earth. And Job in particular talks about why we need all these different life forms to be in place on planet Earth before we humans show up. I mean, after all, if God were not to do what we see in creation day 5 and 6, which is create animals, birds and mammals, that God has designed to serve and please us and to emotionally relate to us, we would have never been able to get out of the Stone Age. And the evidence for that is people groups that lacked those animals remain at a low population level and remain to a Stone Age technology. It took cows, it took horses, goats, and sheep to enable us to develop the agricultural industry that catapulted us out of the Stone Age. In other words, it took those animals in order for us to develop a sufficient surplus of food that we could set people free to make tools and to develop technology. So if you look at the history of humanity, early humans, 98% of the humans were employed to come up with food for the community. And today that percentage is below 2%. Here in America, it's below 1%, which means 99% of us get to write novels, do art, music, engineering, technology, science, computer advances. We're able to do all of that because we have this huge surplus of food provided by just 1% of our population. But none of that would have been possible unless we had the plants and the animals. And we're talking earlier about insects. One thing I wrote in Weathering Climate Change, it took ants being introduced. Ants are relatively recent. They've only been around for the past 23 million years. But ants, as well as termites, play a crucial role in ensuring that we're pulling out just the right amount of greenhouse gases to compensate for the brightening of the sun. So yeah, don't take ants for granted. God created them so that we can live and thrive at this time. And hey, I'll put a plug in, read Improbable Planet. That's a good book to go to see all of the things that God did in his design to make possible human existence and human civilization. Do we have another online question?
No, I don't see any. Wait a minute, 1 second. Here's one from Tim Williams. It says the Still et al. Paper on the Cambrian explosion caused notes possible life on Earth 4.1 billion years ago. How do you assess that early life claim? Are there implications for RTB's creation model?
Yeah, good question. Tim Williams is actually on our board of directors. And a good question from Tim. There are claims that people are seeing isotope signatures for life in rocks, zircons in particular, that are as old as 4.1 billion years. Probably the most credible is one from rocks around Great Slave Lake in northern Canada. But none of the claims for the signatures of life of 4.1 billion years are conclusive. The evidence is strong, but not conclusive. But that's one reason why Faisal Rana and I, when we came out with a book on the origin of life, we purposely titled it Origins of Life, because we have undisputed evidence that microbial life goes back as far as 3.825 billion years. But there are these zircons that they discovered in even more ancient rocks that have the isotopes that appear to be signatures for microbial life being earlier. And we do know, based on those zircons, that the Hadean era, that's referred to as the era before the late heavy bombardment, when the Earth was so hellishly hot that life was impossible. Zircons now show us that there were brief episodes in specific locations on the Earth where liquid water actually formed and where rocks formed, where certain kinds of rocks formed. But these were episodes that were temporary and isolated. It wasn't universal. And explains why the zircon evidence for these isotope signatures of life predating 3.8 billion years are rare and isolated. What it's telling us is that there are indeed these rare isolated conditions on the Earth where we had not hellishly hot conditions, but where we actually could have liquid water and rocks temporarily existing. So this isn't permanent liquid water. It's not permanent rocks. The earliest time we see permanent liquid water and permanent rocks is 3.825 billion years ago. But earlier than that, we do see evidence for rocks and liquid water. But to me, if this actually stands up as compelling evidence that this isotopes really are telling us life was existing as far back as 4.1 billion years ago, episodically and temporarily, that tells me that the Creator was being very aggressive in preparing the Earth as quickly as possible for more advanced life. In other words, it's a Creator that didn't wait until there were permanent stable rocks and permanent stable liquid water, but actually took advantage of these brief episodes of liquid water and existing rocks, certain kinds of rocks, and actually created life as early as possible and as aggressively as possible. And you actually see a hint of that in Psalm 104. As you read Psalm 104, it's God packing the earth with as much life as possible and as diverse as possible. And so that interpretation of Psalm 104 would fit the model of God stepping in, even where it's only episodically possible for life to exist, actually stepping in and creating that life. Because that early life, the early introduction of microbes, begins to chemically transform the planet for advanced life. And what was an open question when we came out with the book Origins of Life, how early does God need to intervene in order to get the chemistry that's needed for advanced life at the time that's optimal for we human beings? So, still an unanswered question, but it could be answered. And yeah, sometime down the road, we'll bring out a new edition of Origins of Life.
I got a question from Bud here.
Dr. Ross, at the risk of speaking ahead to the next presentation, in your new book, Design to the Core, you're talking about the Cosmic Flows 3 results.
Yes.
And our Linacea, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, I hope.
Yeah, Linacea supercluster.
What's responsible for making our Linacea supercluster so unusual, so unique? I didn't quite grasp what was the sort of great attractors or whatever the dynamic mechanism.
Well, that survey I referred to in the book is basically how they were able to define for the first time what a super galaxy cluster was. There's two surveys where they were looking at galaxy clusters and galaxies, millions of them, within the local universe, and very carefully measuring the velocities of the galaxies. And what they did is they subtracted out the velocity of the galaxy due to the expansion of the universe. The cosmic expansion rate has now been measured with sufficient precision that for the first time it was actually possible to do that and wind up with what they call a peculiar velocity. So when astronomers talk about a peculiar velocity of a galaxy, that's the velocity of the galaxy where they subtract out the velocity due to the expansion of the universe, which gives you the velocity of the galaxy due to gravitational interactions with matter in its environment. And so what you'll see there in the book Design to the Core is that by measuring those peculiar velocities, they were able to see super galaxy clusters for the first time. Super galaxy clusters are where the galaxies, the local groupings of galaxies, the clusters of galaxies, where they're all kind of moving towards the same center. And so they define the Lanikaia supercluster of galaxies as that boundary where the galaxies are moving towards the center of the Lanikaia supercluster as opposed to moving away. And then they were able to actually do the same thing. The next one they were able to do it for was a Shapley supercluster. And noticing they could put a boundary around the galaxy clusters that make up the Shapley supercluster and actually define, hey, there again, we can look at the peculiar velocities and see that all of those galaxies and galaxy clusters are being pulled towards a gravitational center. Now, it was really challenging for the Lanikaia supercluster is that our supercluster of galaxies is dispersing. Because of the expansion of the universe, it's actually being dispersed. But if you take out the cosmic expansion, we can see the velocities where they're heading towards a common gravitational center. Whereas with the Shapley supercluster of galaxies, it's such a dense supergalaxy cluster that it's not going to disperse anytime in the near future. It's going to be stable for many billions of years, whereas the Lanikaia supercluster is in the process of being dispersed. So hopefully that helps. But yeah, we're going to talk about superclusters of galaxies next week, or 2 weeks from now.
You got a question from Mark Wilburn. What happened to the antimatter? And was that antimatter destruction event before or after the inflationary event?
Okay, good question. What he's referring to is that when the universe was created, it had approximately equal amounts of ordinary matter matter and antimatter. But as the different forces of physics separate out from one another, the universe begins with just one single force, and at 10 to the minus 43 seconds, you get the gravitational force and the strong electroweak force. So now we got two forces. And at 10 to the minus 35 seconds, the strong electroweak force separates into the strong nuclear force and the electroweak force. And I forget the exact time, it's around a trillionth of a second after the cosmic creation event. The weak nuclear force separates out from the electromagnetic force. And from that point onward, the universe has four distinct forces of physics. But every time a force of physics separates out from the others, you get a symmetry breaking. And so theoretical astrophysicists believe that what happened at the inflation event at 10 to the minus 35 seconds is that you have the annihilation. You get a symmetry breaking where you got slightly more matter as compared to antimatter, and the difference is tiny. We're talking like 100 billion and one real particles for every 100 billion antiparticles. And you get the great annihilation event. And the 100 billion cancel out the other 100 billion, and what's left is the one. And so the universe is an extremely sharp drop in the total mass. And if it wasn't for that annihilation event, we'd have too much matter in the universe. And so we wind up with just the right amount of matter. Now, do astronomers and physicists completely understand that symmetry breaking? They don't. But they do know if it wasn't for that symmetry breaking occurring, there'd be no life possible in the universe. And so there's something special about the four laws, four forces of physics that actually enabled life to exist in the universe. They have to symmetry break in just the right ways. And there's been books written on the antimatter event, and it's still being debated. It's not fully understood at this time. But there is a consensus that there was an annihilation event where the almost equal quantities of matter and antimatter annihilated one another. E equals mc squared. The matter basically got transformed into energy. And so that heated up the universe, but it also brought down the matter of the universe to the just right level. And the energy we got up was also just right.
Well, here it's getting kind of late. Do you want one more question?
No, we're at a point where we need to wrap things up. So we'll take questions next time. Right. And as usual, people live in person or live online, they can raise any question they wish. We don't put boundaries on the kinds of questions that can be asked. And I also take questions on Facebook and Twitter. Right. So that let me close us in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the privilege of being alive in the 21st century when we got this amazing technology that's revealing your glory and righteousness revealed in the heavens like never before. So yes, because of human activity, our huge population, our technology, we have light pollution and air pollution that diminishes the glory of God revealed in the heavens, but we see it enhanced thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope and now the James Webb Space Telescope, Square Kilometer Array, and many other telescopes that are in operation, more to come. And Father, I pray that glory revealed in the heavens would cause us to humble ourselves before you. We pray for all the scientists that are using this amazing technology, that they would recognize the glory of God being revealed, and not just the glory of God, but the righteousness of God, in designing everything in such a way that we can discover the existence of God, his attributes, and his plan of salvation. So, Father, I pray that you would give us the humility to receive what you've revealed in the record of nature and see how it points us to what you revealed in the book of Scripture and how in those two revelations you make it so clear that you desire a relationship with us and that you're prepared to forgive us of all of our offenses against you and one another, and to step by step transform us into the image of Christ, where we can be set completely free of sin and evil. In Jesus' name, amen.